Hey everyone, you are listening to Jotos Recuerdos. Today I'm interviewing a very special guest. I have been following Anel Flores' work for a very long time. My best friend Gladys actually gifted me their book, Empanada, and I completely fell in love with it, and it inspired me to write some of my own things and create some of my own stuff. And then when I went to Paris for the Gloria Anzaldúa conference, I was able to meet Anel in person. And I actually was completely shook because as I was presenting, I see Anel come in. I was like, is this really happening right now? Is she really here? And then we got to actually talk and hang out. And I got to meet her amazing daughter and other people in her life that are important to her. And so I'm so grateful to be able to have had that experience and form that relationship. And now I get to document a little bit of her story. So without any further ado, I'm introducing Anel, who is on the line with me now.
Hey, how are you doing? I'm so happy to talk to you again after Paris. How are you doing, everyone?
So could you tell us your name, how you identify in terms of race, gender, and sexuality?
All right. So I definitely want to start with just saying butch. I always bring that first out because I believe when I started my life over again, you know, from being a presenting straight person as a teenager to being queer, it was butch women that like helped me, guided me, pulled me through different things. So I always want to identify as a butch woman. I go by she, her, they, them. It's definitely gender non-binary. However, I hold on to my woman as well. Very important to me. I'm a lesbiana. I'm a chicana. I'm a tejana. I'm mexicana. And I use all those terms everywhere because I believe that I don't want any of those terms to go away. I don't want to erase them. You know, in the non-binary and in that fluid space on the spectrum, I feel that is very important to be able to not bind me in any place in terms of like necessarily race or ethnicity or gender. However, the words, you know, as usual for me as a writer and a poet and a fiction writer, words are very important, and it is words that have grounded me. So I continue to use the labels, I continue to use those terms, because those words are grounding, those words are historic, those words are placemakers for time. So I have many identities, and they all come together in my body and my spirit.
That is so beautiful. Can you just talk a little bit about what does it mean to be butch?
Wow, so many things, but my butch is in my presentation. I feel that butchness in my style, in my aesthetic, the way that I stand, the way I present myself, and just in the history that I hold on to as butches. But in terms of who I am, I'm soft. Butches are soft. Butches are lovable. For me, the butch is this is a person who will honor the femme, honor the women energy, honor the feminine energy to the top. And that's what I do for sure. So that's what I've learned from other butches.
Yeah. What does it mean to be Chicana?
I had this conversation with our daughters when they were little, but they were 9, 10, and you know, to me, Chicana, and this is the way I learned it, you know, and it might sound generic, but I learned it early on in the 90s that Chicana was a person who is actively working towards social change and social justice for the Mexican and the Mexican-American, the immigrant, the people of color community, for the community that is underserved, for the community that's erased, for the community that is quote-unquote marginalized. The Chicana does that work does social justice work through their medium. And mine is in my writing, in my art, and also in my activism. So as a Chicana, I'm active. I feel like it's an active word. It's a word that says I'm doing the work, not only by doing the, you know, protests, but also by just doing the work of existing as a Chicana, of vocalizing yourself, being vocal about the history of education and our rights and everything in this country and how we've survived. I think being a Chicana is just knowing what that story is, telling that story to more young people or all people that might not know it, and continuing to do the fight in our homes, in our streets, in our countries, and our work everywhere.
And I think that's a perfect segue to talk a little bit about where you grew up. So can you tell us what part of Texas that you grew up in?
All right. So I was born in Brownsville, baptized at Our Lady of Guadalupe Church. But I also, spent my time very much in Los Alamos, Texas, which is right near the border. spent my time in Dia Soledad in Mexico, spent my time in Mission, in McAllen, Edinburgh as a young child, and then every summer the same because we later moved to San Antonio. Like most people, I mean, well, like a lot of people, our parents worked, you know, they were constantly working, waking up at 5 in the morning, gone all day, come home at 8 p.m. So because of that kind of schedule in the summers, I spent, my parents would send me back to the Valley to be with my grandmother. So I did my summers in the Valley growing up and my school years in San Antonio, Christmases and Thanksgivings and every holiday you could imagine down to the Valley, because that's where our grandparents were and our cousins and uncles and aunts. So I grew up in both places. I grew up on the drive. I grew up driving, you know, 37 and Highway 77 back and forth. That landscape, the stories that on the highways, just going back and forth, and always remembering, you know, back before there was a huge freeze, and there used to be palm trees that, man, I felt like when I was a kid, they touched the sky. They were so tall, and we would be driving in from San Antonio, and my dad would be like, "There they are, like they're the palm trees," and you could just see lines. I mean, a perfect line of palm trees, like just. Certain point right before, I think it was right before Harlan, and you just see them just going, boom, just lines and lines and lines of palm trees, and I knew, okay, I'm home, my other home.
Absolutely. Palm trees are definitely a signifier for the Valley. So I want to talk about what was it like for you growing up as a, you know, a butch person or a queer person in the Valley?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm going to start with my family because it's the first thing that came up. My cousins were such a strong part of my life. I have 17 cousins total that when the problems were hard with the adults, which they were, because all my tios and tias were not having it at the time. This was in 94 that I was outed to my family, not under my conditions. And my cousins, you know, all my cousins and half of them are in the Valley are so wonderful. They were always like protecting me and standing shoulder to shoulder. If I went down like for an Easter event or like, you know, I was in Los Alamos for Easter. And this was during that time that my parents weren't talking to me, but I had to go to Easter because then my grandmother would wonder, you know, just, it's all very complicated. It's like, you have to show up even though you're hiding a secret. And my cousins would just stand by me like shoulder to shoulder. Or do you want to go here? Do you want to go here? Let's come with me. And they wouldn't leave me alone. And they were protecting me from these like little snide comments of, you know, from family, from community or outside people in the Valley. You know, the people in the Valley are so nice and kind. So strangers in the Valley, I never have felt unsafe. I've never felt unloved, unwanted in these lands, honestly, in San Antonio or the Valley, only by maybe my family that have been, you know, just, they weren't ready for it in the 90s and the early 2000s. They weren't ready to understand it because of religion. But in terms of people and the Chicanos and the Mexicanos and my gente, you know, it's, for me, it's, everybody has just been love. And maybe they don't agree that I'm queer. And I think that's what's so interesting, too, about our people and our community is that, you know, even like, you might have the random, like, person that appeared, like, to be homophobic. Like, let's say we would assume, right, which I don't want to do, but we do. We assume stereotypically that someone coming off the rancho is going to be homophobic, right? They have boots, and they got the belt, and they got the boots, and then they got the whole thing with the hat. You think it's your tío's tío or something coming, walking down the street, and you look at him, and you think, oh, damn, you know, this is going to be some ugly or mean, or, you know, maybe they're gonna make a remark at me, but no, it's what is the, it's kind people. So I'm gonna just say that from my experience in these lands here, it's been beautiful because I think it's the spirit of our people, of our gente, you know, in that larger sense, it's been good. And I'm proud of the Valley. I've seen some great things coming out of the Valley these last several years with the Pride and with Aquí Estamos and just different events, being invited down there to speak at the university and the libraries. And, you know, I've had good experiences.
That's beautiful. And it's something that I definitely have come across in the Valley. You know, there are people who could give you looks, but then there are other people who just they, at the end of the day, it's like la familia, right? So they're accepting, yeah, and they're like, that's my primo's friend, like whatever, you know. So,
yeah,
yeah. And so then there comes this wave of understanding or acceptance. And so my next question is, what was your coming out journey for you? Was it connected to religion? Was it connected to your body?
Well, so then, yeah, that's another, it's a whole other, it's like total polar opposite of what I was just talking about. But so, you know, my family is Catholic, super Catholic. My tia went to the convent. My mother almost went to the convent. So there's a lot of little intricacies there that affected my coming out. And so at 17, I was forced out. My girlfriend at the time and I went to a concert, true story, and her mom, insisted that she drive us. We were kids, you know, in high school. And she was my girlfriend at the time, but of course, you know, like young queers, she's my best friend. So she was my best friend. We go to this concert. Her mom drops us off. Beautiful concert. For any, you know, 90s and early 2000 lesbians, we went to see Sarah McLachlan, which was like, you know, the stereotypical lesbian concert, you know. Beautiful. Everyone's crying. It's all women. You know, you're in Austin. At that time, concerts are different. It was literally almost like 90% women and queer. It was beautiful. And so we're at this concert, and then it ends. It's about 10:30, 11 at night. And I'm a senior in high school. And she says, my girlfriend says, okay, well, let me give you a kiss before we leave. Because, you know, then we have to get in the car and then we're friends again. And then, you know, okay. So she gives me a kiss. And, you know, of course, I'm like, oh, my God. It's, you know, it's like my first girlfriend. Everything's so dreamy and magical. And I'm seeing Sarah McLachlan. Everything's gorgeous. And then all of a sudden, I feel a hand on the back of my shirt in a kind of a pool. And it's her mother. She came into the concert somehow, like right at the entrance, pulled us apart. The drive, you know, and it was just yelling and screaming and I'm going to hell and why am I doing this to her daughter and I'm disgraced and I'm disgusting and I can't believe this. This is embarrassing. I mean, it was an hour and a half drive from Austin to San Antonio listening to how disgusting I was and how bad I was and how she was going to call the cops and how we could never see each other again. And I'm crying. She's crying. Of course, I'm also like, my stomach is spinning and turning around in circles because I'm thinking about she's going to call my mother. And the shit's over. Like, I'm done. Like, it's over. You know, my grandmother's at home. My mom's there. My sister's there. It's going to be really fucking bad right now. And we're driving this hour and a half home. And then we get to her house where my car is parked. And she, of course, is like, get out of here. No, you can't come in the house. And go to your car. And this is, you know, pre-cell phone. Mm-hmm. So I don't have a cell phone or a pager. It's even pre-pager, if you can imagine. And so she's like, you'll never see each other again. Don't ever call, you know. And, of course, I'm going to call your mom. And I'm going to tell your mom what you did to my daughter. It's all my fault. The way that it's being presented, and I'm, you know, shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. And I get in the car, I drive across town and to a payphone and get out of the car, have some change. I call one of my best friends who, luckily, her grandmother, like, never slept. I don't know why she was always awake, but the funny part is I call at, like, 2 a.m, right, And my best friend's grandmother, Mrs. Wadlia, rest her soul, she was a beautiful woman. I'm like, Mrs. Wadlia, can I speak to Monica? And she screams. It's 2 a.m. I'm outside of the payphone, and Mrs. Wadlia is sitting I know, I can visualize it. She's sitting downstairs in her kitchen, I know it, and she screams to the second floor of their house. And there's a bunch of people that live there. But I hear her, Monica, Anel's on the phone, and of course I'm crying. And she keeps screaming for Monica because she can hear that I'm crying. And then Monica picks up the phone. And I go straight to her house. She's like, just come over. Luckily, I had a friend like that. You know, she was actually the first person that ever knew I was gay. I told her I was gay that year, like probably a month before, 2 months before that happened. Mm-hmm. So I call her. I come over, Mrs. Wabi has in the kitchen, I give her a kiss, 2 a.m, I go upstairs to my best friend's bedroom, and I'm up just crying, I'm terrified, and then I get a call from my girlfriend. She's just like, you need to go home, because my mom is about to call your mother, like, it could happen any minute now, so you need to go home. So, of course, my mom will not answer. We don't have a phone in the bedrooms or anything. So I knew she wasn't going to answer the phone. So I waited till about 6 a.m. I drove home. My mom was already awake at that time. And she's cleaning the shower. She was inside of the shower. So I went into the bathroom. It was Saturday morning at this point. So it's cleaning time. And I go into the bathroom and she's like, you know, telling me good morning and telling me what chores I'm going to do and what's my morning chore list or whatever. And so I'm kind of frozen there in front of her, and she looks at me and she's like, what's wrong? And I'm like, just frozen. Like, I don't even know how to get the words out of my mouth. I don't know what to say. She has like a towel in her hand and bleach in the other. And, you know, it's in cleaning mode. My grandmother's on the other side of the door from the bathroom. And I'm just like quiet. And she's like, what's wrong? I'm like, just don't know what to say. She says, what happened? What's going on? And then the phone rings. I'm like, damn. Then my grandmother comes in. She's like, you know, Mrs. So-and-so's on the phone. This is the mom of my girlfriend. And then my mom just looks at me like with her eyes, like just drills into my eyes. And she tells my grandmother, like, tell her I'll call her later. So I'm like, whew, save, you know? But then my grandmother leaves. And my mom's just like, what did you do? And I'm like, nothing. She's like, what did you do? I'm like, nothing. She's like, what did you do? Did you get caught smoking? I'm like, no. Did you get caught drinking? No. Were you stealing? No. She's like, what did you do? And then I just was like, she saw us kissing. She saw us kiss or something like really simple. And then my mom was like, kiss like what? You know, and then like, I see the rage comes out and the bleach down, the bra down. She's coming out of the bathroom and I'm backing up. So I just said, kissing on the mouth. And she's just like, oh my God. And I can't believe this. And I'm going to call the priest and I got to call this and you can't tell anybody. And this is disgusting. I didn't raise you. You're not my daughter. This is the person I'm with. This is not my daughter. I didn't do this. You need to get out of here. This is sinful and you know, I mean, she's just, it is just like, gross. And I'm crying, everyone's crying. It was so fast and blurry and violent and just sad. It was violent in a verbal way. And, you know, from that moment forward, she didn't talk to me for probably 2 years. I mean, they were just a good morning kiss if I were to come home, if I were to visit home. But we didn't talk. Like, she literally, in my memory and from what I know, she laid in bed for a few years, depressed. She talked to many priests. She talked to everybody she could. I left home and because I wasn't wanted at all. It was very expressed to me very many times that I was not wanted, that I was not part of the family. And luckily, my best friend, the one who I called to begin with, was going to college because I had no plans to go to college. I actually wanted to just like paint and I don't know what I was going to do, but I had no plans. Let's just say that. But I was about to graduate. So my best friend was like, well, I'm going to this school and I have a dorm. And I was kind of like overhearing her and my other best friend. And I was like, well, I guess I'd better find a home, you know? So I applied for college. I got in, luckily. I dormed with them, so, you know, it was that kind of transition where I didn't have a place to live, so the college became my home, you know, luckily, and did that. My father was so wonderful. He did tell me at one point, he said, you know, I love you. All I want for you is happiness. You know, all I want for you is to be safe. All I want for you is to not be abused, to not be hurt, to just be loved. You know, he was very clear that he wanted me to be happy and whatever that looked like. But he did say, he said, but, you know, I married your mother first, you know, and he said, and so my love has to be for her first, he told me. You know, my commitment is to her. And so that was heartbreaking at the time, you know, because I thought, well, at least I have my dad, you know, like, and I did in a spiritual way, but it sucked super bad. Luckily, I had those friends that I moved in with, and a lot of great people that came into my life soon after, but those, like, those years were horrible. That were kind of just, like, blurry and painful. I don't know, I mean, I'm pretty sure I got through college by going to drag shows, like, five nights a week, because that was the way I became stronger. I would study all day and then go to the club at night, and all the drag queens were so fierce and gorgeous and dreamy and powerful, and they were activists in their own right, that they kept me strong. I got a lot of influence from being at the club, and just got through it, you know? My parents, it's been 20-something years now, so things have changed a lot with a lot of work. You know, that's my story, part of it. There's a lot more, but that's part of it.
Thanks for sharing.
Yeah, I got some tears in there, so thank you for letting me get some tears out during cancer season. I'm all
Oh my God, I've already been crying this entire month.
Yeah, same, no, same. Yeah. Just not new.
That's heavy, and you know, to hear and to carry. And, you know, my mom, when she came out, her mom did not talk to her for 10 years. But I didn't know, because I still had a relationship with my grandma. My mom still made it a point for us to have a relationship with our grandmother. But now that, you know, my grandma recently diagnosed with cancer, and I've been having more conversations with her, and she told me, she said, you know, yeah, I didn't talk to your mom for 10 years, but, you know, that was my first daughter who came out, and then she had another daughter come out, and then she had a granddaughter, and she was like, well, I'm going to have to accept it. It's a journey. It's a journey for everyone.
Yeah. It really is.
And you know, you're a parent now, and you have a beautiful family, and I want to talk a little bit about you being a parent, but before we do, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, the gay club scene that you were a part of. Can you talk a little bit about that? And
yeah. So let's see. So here, because I was in San Antonio, the clubs that I did go to the most here, was the Saint. Well, there was the Saint, there was Miriam's, which is a women's, like a lesbian club. There was the Saint, which was a gay club that had amazing drag shows, like amazing. So there was the Saint, there was Miriam's, which is a women's bar. There was a couple bars, like I think there was a bar called Dos Hermanas here in San Antonio on the south side. There was another bar here in San Antonio called The Boss that was like in a warehouse, basically out, like the parking was like dirt road, kind of dirt rocks and caliche. It was like a super kind of the Hannah Butch run bar, which was amazing. There was great drag shows there, great shows. And the real Chicano at the Boss was great. In the Valley, 10th Avenue is where I went. But the 10th Avenue, yeah, 10th Avenue is where my cousins would take me and where I've gone. That's definitely the one that I remember the most. But no, the clubs scene is just what I love about it. And what was so romantic for me early on in the Valley and in San Antonio going to these clubs was that there was always like a designated Tejano night. And that was like amazing because I would go and when I would walk in and see like women's cheek, you know, like cheek walking, dancing Tejano or dancing a cumbia or, oh my God, I felt like I was transferred back into like the wedding when I was 11 years old at the, you know, at some like church hall. And I felt like I was transformed back to my childhood where all my cousins came in, you know, Tejanos, Chicanos, Mexicanos, they're all coming in doing dancing and doing the cumbia, but in a queer, through a queer lens. All of a sudden I was going to these bars and it was like my primos were dancing, but they weren't my primos. They were just queer folks that were coming out in the dark, you know, They were coming out when nobody knew, you know, I could tell, you could see like older men, older gay men that would come in after work, you know, come in with their uniform, their uniform of working a domestic job. They come to the bar, they're sitting at the end of the bar at the Tejano night, and they're older gay men and they're young gay men women that looked like my tías, and dancing tejano with another woman was like, oh, so gorgeous. It makes my heart just like, you know, literally like a cartoon, like just flutter around, you know, it makes my chest flutter just to think of these two tejana women dancing together. And so for me, the club, watching that scene was beautiful in the valley and here, especially on Tejano night. Drag queens, I remember thinking to myself, because I was with myself, you know, I would go to the club a lot alone just because I needed to get out. I needed to feel like I could be gay. You know, you're just kind of trapped in this like heteronormative world. We still are every day. But when you go to this club and everyone is like just being them, you know, like lovely and powerful and gorgeous. And the drag queens, man, I would look at them and think, fuck, like, what am I scared about? You know, I would think to myself, like, I have nothing to be scared of. These drag queens, they were fucking fierce, man. They were just, like, head tall, heels on stage. And I would think to myself, like, that right there is a woman. Like a woman who's just, like, I'm going to show you everything. I'm going to be everything. I'm going to be the most powerful. I'm going to, you know, nothing is going to stop me. And that's what I saw watching these drag shows. And I still have the same passion for drag queens and performance. And that's where I got my animal. That's where I learned how to be strong. And to, you know, now looking, being able to look at my life in a different way. I'm 43. So now I can see the strength that my mother had and the work she had to endure, the pain she had to endure at that time period. So for now, I see the ánimo in my mother and my tías and my grandmother and everybody else. But at that time, the strongest woman in my circle of reach was the drag queen. And so the club did that for me. The club just like probably gave me 80% of the strength I have. I'm not even kidding.
And you know, I love that you bring up the Tejano night, because for me, you know, and I keep bringing my parents up, but they would go to 10th Avenue to dance cumbia because that was what was real to them. And I think that it's very beautiful when you think about the gay clubs in the Valley or in San Antonio in South Texas, that they are reflective of who we are. And we're not just gay or butch or, you know, or queer. Yeah. We're gay and Mexican or gay and Tejano or gay and, you know, Latino or Afro-Latino, etc. And so I think that those Tejano nights are really magical. And now when I think about gay clubs, we went to some in Paris. And it was interesting to see the contrast, because I always think, man, I wish they played like a Selena song right now, or I wish they had a, you know, some kind of cumbia, Ramon Ayala, something like, because I want to create those moments of just like swaying your body back and forth with another, you know, body. And yeah, it's something that I think about for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I wrote about it. In Empanada, I wrote a story about, you know, just being in, I think it's called, I mean, I'm pretty sure it's called The Next Song. It's a dreamscape where I walk into the club, it's the Tejano night, and I see my mother across the room, the way I would see her at a wedding. It's beautiful to go to the club and see that space and to move your body, but it's another thing to say, I'm queer in my space. You know, like, and growing up, that music, the music, the dancing, the swaying that you talked about, you know, I dance with my mother in the kitchen every day, every week. I dance with my grandmother in the kitchen to that music. So in the club, it's like you, in that story, I was like, this is my space. Like, this is my queer space, but I want you to be here, Mom. You know, I want you to be here, Grandma. I want our space to be queer. I want it to be this safe. And it's like, you know, you're merging two worlds. Is that possible? Like, how can we get there? So in that dreamscape, it was like, how can I meet my mother and all people that are afraid of queerness, right? Because of outside stories, because of colonized stories. How can we meet? And to me, like, the safest place is there on the dance floor, in those rhythms, in that movement, in your body, you know, just like, yeah, it's like the most magical place. And I still haven't got to that place in my family that I can live in both worlds, where I can completely live 100% queer and 100% Chicana, Mexicana, Tejana. I'm not there. And I don't know who is, right? But my whole family, as much as they love me, we're not there. Like, a couple of my family members, four of them, actually, I can count them on my hand, went to my wedding. Out of 17 cousins and probably 100 other relatives, four of them went to the wedding. It's still like, we're still not there, you know? Mm-hmm. We're still not 100% there, but so, yeah.
And so let's talk a little bit about your family.
Yeah, of course, of course.
So I got to meet your daughter in Paris, but you have, you know, a very queer family. I saw you post amazing pictures at Pride, all y'all looking fabulous. And so you're a parent, you know, like you're a queer parent, you have a queer family. What's that like? What has that experience been like for you?
Oh my gosh, it's amazing. Just to start, you know, it's been 11 years. My daughters are 20 and 24 now. Erika is my wife. Erika is amazing. She's also an artist and a cuandera, a beautiful soul. And on our second meeting, which was at Woodland Park here in San Antonio, our second time, like, actually having a conversation, we sat on this little bridge at Woodland Park and on the west side, and she said to me, my daughters come first, no matter what. She's like, if we continue to date or talk, my daughters come first. And I'll never forget that, because we actually met at the perfect time. You know, we had been in and out of, you know, you're in and out of relationships in your 20s. And I was already at a good place where I was able to tell her, you know, my writing comes first. And I really was just very much about that. I had been taught by some great teachers that said, you know, you need to tell anyone you meet that your writing comes first. And so I said that for the first time in my life to her. She said her daughters come first. And then what was so great was just verbalizing that made our relationship and our family dynamic just come together so perfectly. Because the girls at that time were nine and 12. And they knew right away, you know, that, you know, this woman that their mother was dating, and eventually, you know, us moving in together and so on and so forth, was a writer. Whenever we did finally live together, you know, I have an office with these French doors, like little windows, and they knew that in the morning they would wake up and they would not come into this little room. And I would have to explain to them, like, it has nothing to do with you. Like, it's just, I need this time for me. And I think Erika was so wonderful to help me establish these guidelines, to teach them, you know, for them to watch a writer grow up, right? For them to watch me grow up as a writer and see that example of, like, even just alone time, right? Or quiet time in a home. And Erika had already established that in the girls, like, reading time, and they had drawing time, and they had reading time and quiet time. And so it's just so, it was so magical. It was a different way of growing up. And it was very interesting for me, because I had been, you know, of course, dating, but never in this kind of commitment. I'm so in love with the girls. They're so brilliant. I had no idea I could love anybody this much, you know, like anybody. I love them so much. They're brilliant. They're smart. Erika taught me how to, you know, communicate. She's such a good communicator. She, early on, when they were 9 and 11, she was already implementing the language of, like, how do you know, who do you like, this little girl or this little boy or this little person? She was already talking in, like, gender-neutral terms. And this was in 2009 or whatever. What year is it? I think it was, like, 2009. Yeah, 2008. They were little, and she was already, like, very much queering the space. And I did not know how to do that, because I grew up in a heteronormative family, you know, very hetero family. But she was so taught me how to just, like, communicate with them about their bodies, about gender, about masturbation and sex and everything. Like, it was so beautiful the way she raised them. And I learned how to be a good mother by watching her. And I cannot even believe it. We have this beautiful queer family. And I joke about how, like, you know, people say, oh my gosh, gay parents raising kids, you're going to turn them gay. I'm like, okay, first of all, my straight parents could not keep me straight. Right. So that doesn't work. But now I'm like, damn, our whole entire family's queer. It's so awesome. I'm so happy. Because they're super, like, I mean, our young, you know, our daughters are just brilliant. They are super out. They stand up for us all the time. Both of them have encountered homophobia at school, through teachers, through parents, through friends. And, you know, they will come home and tell us what's happening. Like, maybe this parent won't let their friend come over because we're gay, or this teacher said didn't let one of them do a project on, like, same-sex marriage because it was just, like, she wasn't going to approve it. Or, you know, just things do happen. You know, it happened to them a lot. And they went through a lot because of us. But they just came out on the other end strong, you know. And Erika and I, at some point, once they were about 16, if they came home with some problems, like, at school, you know, that were involved, like, homophobic kind of comments or things, we told them, you know, we can go to the school or we can call the parent, we can call the mom or the dad, or we can let you handle it, you know. And we kind of talked to them about how to handle those situations right around 15, 16, because we knew that they were going to have to handle those on their own, because we weren't going to always be there. You know, they were going to get older and they were going to have to learn how to stand up for themselves and who they are and who their parents are and who transgender people are and who, you know, who dykes are, who queers are. They needed to know the vocabulary and the language. And so we gave them that. We tried to give them that. And of course, we definitely missed a lot because we're older and they teach us things all the time. They're, you know, now obviously making sure that we're very clear about gender with people, pronouns, and they're teaching us how to ask, you know, like, ask what their pronouns are. They're teaching us how to, like, they're so good. They're telling us, like, oh, this is the new lingo. So now they're teaching us, we're teaching them, we're keeping the history. I love it. They're young activists in their own right. Gladys is doing activism in college. Jessica's doing activism in her writing and her work. And they're brilliant. I don't even know what to say. I could go on and on.
No,
I really could talk for, like, weeks about how brilliant they are, but I don't know.
And I think it's beautiful that, you know, you have that queer family in your life. I want to talk about Empanada next. And, well, just about what you do now. So we, you know, for people who have been listening, we spoke about Empanada earlier, but we didn't quite introduce it. So, now, can you talk a little bit about what you do now and...
Yeah, absolutely. So Empanada, you know, came about, and it's connected to earlier stories. It's like, I remember my parents asked me, I don't know how many years ago, but many years ago, they were like, why did you, in Empanada, because it tells the story of a young coming out, woman coming out in South Texas, and it against the landscape of her grandmother and what her grandmother's silence is. And of course, within the book, there's a lot of eroticism and sexiness and raciness and drama and religion and all kinds of things. But my parents asked me, why did you include your grandmother in this book? Like, why did you write her like that? Because it's not true, right? It's fiction, but fiction always comes from experience. So my grandmother is very evidently there. And I told my parents, I said, you know, did you look at their eyes? Like, both of my grandmothers, like, they had so many stories that we did not allow them to say. We did not give them a platform to tell us, you know, who their first love was or who their first kiss was or if they were queer. We never even asked them, like, hey, did you ever like a girl? Or did you ever think a young woman was sexy? Or, hey, did you ever want to, you know, change your body? Did you ever want to dress differently? You know, I told my parents, you know, you made them wear dresses. Like, they had to wear dresses every day of their life. They had to be in the kitchen every day of their life. They had to only talk about their husbands their whole life. They had to live this very silent, quiet life that I refused to be a part of. Like, I refused to, like, encourage that space. So when I wrote Empanada, I was like, I'm going to write about my grandmother. I'm going to write about that story that could be behind her eyes, behind my eyes. Those secrets that we tell in the kitchen, the secrets we put into our food. That's what Empanada was about, you know, the secrets we put into our mouth, all those things we needed to tell and wrap it around eroticism and love and passion and desire. So for me, Empanada came from that hunger to tell stories. And so I wrote that for many years. It was a play that toured around the country for 10 years as well. And the play turned into a full manuscript during grad school for me, which I was super happy to write and then publish with Gudima Press. and with the assistance of Mariana Romo Carmona, who is a Chilena queer writer who's based in New York now, I was super amazingly lucky to meet her in grad school. She was the one Spanish-speaking queer writer in my program. She was my advisor, thank God. At that time, in 2004, 2002, she was the only Spanish-speaking queer writer in an MFA low residency program all over the country. Yeah. I mean, I'm the only one. And I just landed, in, thank God, in her lap. She's a brilliant writer. She has several books out. And so she assisted me in writing Empanada in grad school. And then, of course, was a Macondo writer. I'm a Macondo writer with Sandra Cisneros. So I did a lot of work with Sandra in workshop and other amazing writers like Ruth Behar, Carla Trujillo, another amazing Chicana lesbiana mm-hmm. writer, Leslie Larson, another lesbiana writer, just so many great people, Dorothy Allison, in working in Panada, and then also in Macondo, working on my second book, which is called Cortinas de Lluvia, which hopefully has a, I'm like 85% sure has a 2020 release date, Cortinas de Lluvia. I'm working on revisions right now with an editor, and it seems very promising. And so hopefully Cortinas de Lluvia will come out. That book is set against the backdrop of Mission, Texas, and the Hayes Salmon's factory pollution. That's the setting. So you're talking about like 70s and 80s. And then, of course, also flashing forward to the 2015, 2018 time, where a young lesbiana goes back to the valley from San Antonio and uncovers the secrets of a lot of her community and also the pollution of Hayes Salmon. So that book will come out in 2020. And then right now I'm working on Pintada de Rojo, which is my graphic memoir, which is now being exhibited. There's some panels being exhibited at the McNay Museum of the graphic memoir, and some more panels of the exhibit being exhibited at Centro de Artes Gallery here in San Antonio, and at the admitted exhibit. And so I have the Trans-American exhibit at the McNay, and then the admitted exhibit at Centro de Artes that's showcasing some of my graphic memoir panels. And that book will be my dream come true, because I've been waiting for the moment for my visual art to fuse with my writing and to make storytelling the storytelling I want to tell. And I finally was able, the switch just like came on when I realized, oh, I could do a graphic memoir. Just like I started to draw and it started to work, it started to come alive. And so I'm working on my graphic memoir, and I have also an editor that I'm talking to, so I'm just gonna put that out in the universe, because that's gonna come out soon too. I don't have any promises, but I always like to put it in the universe, something positive, so it can gain force and really happen. So hopefully sooner than later, I'll get that graphic memoir out as well.
In the spirit of talking about the valley and you know, queerness, lesbian, nidad, as you say it, and how art fuses with writing, can you tell us the story that you told me in Paris about Gloria and Saldúa?
The workshop we had? Okay. So, okay, there's Gloria and Saldúa. Oh, I'm so happy you brought her up. So, yeah, well, first of all, the Esperanza Peace and Justice Center brought her to San Antonio several times. And, oh, my God, I'm so lucky that she... I'm so grateful to all the folks there, Graciela and Gloria and Amy and just all the folks that did that work to bring her to the community. But so I was lucky, thank God, to have her in a... have her for a writing workshop, and it was upstairs at Esperanza. And then, of course, I remember Maria Salazar, who's another one of my butch mentors, my butch daddy loves of my life. She was there. She's an elder butch, and she was in the workshop. And Saldúa, so beautiful, like so dreamy, just in her. She's got this like gorgeous stature. She's very small, petite, like, I don't know, maybe 5'1", I don't remember, but small, smaller than me, and I'm 5'2", so I don't know how much smaller you could get. So she is this petite person, little black hat, and we have these tables squared out, like, you know, like big tables, but in a big square, so there's all these queer folks around the table, and she gives us all a piece of paper, and she, you know, we're getting ready to write, and we all have our journals out, but she's like, no, you know, here's some color pencils and markers and crayons. So we're like, what? You know, everyone's thinking, I'm ready to write. And she's like, we're going to draw. And she says, you know, she's like, I want you to look down on this piece of paper. It's like probably like a big 11 by 17 paper. She's like, and I want you to draw your home. What is your home? Where is that space? Is it a physical home? Is it, what is it? So we have to draw that in the middle of the paper. So then we're all drawing, you know, what our home looks like. And of course, for me, it was tough because I'm like, is it my abuelita's home in Los Sabanos? Is it my grandmother's home in McAllen? Is it my birth home in Brownsville? Is it my San Antonio home? You know, where is it? You know, and I remember drawing just like a little casita. And I wanted to draw like the home in Los Sabanos, which is the southernmost tip for all those cities. And then I drew kind of just like streets and lines then she said, okay, now draw water. Where's the water? So we had to draw that. Now draw the tree. Now draw this. And then she said, now draw a serpent. Right? So we're like, what? And of course, she's adding all these different symbols that she wants us to put in relation to that home. And then from there, of course, she says, okay, you know, the serpent means this, the water means this, the home means this, the tree means this. What does it mean to you? And now write the story of place and home in relation to these symbols and what they mean. And of course, that drawing just turned into this story, right? And so she was on it from the start. She knew that you had to get the visual out, the story out, to get the words out. She knew you had to draw. She knew you had to imagine and envision and see the imagery first. And so to me, that was just like, wow. And I used those exercises in all of my writing workshops now. I always give credit to Ansaldúa. And, you know, maybe one day I'll find in the archives that she's going to give credit to somebody else for that. But for now, she taught me that, you know, you have to envision those stories around home. And whether home, you know, we think home and we're like, oh, how cute, a little beautiful home. Well, home isn't always beautiful, right? What does it look like? What can home look like? And so what does that mean? And, you know, just delving into that to me is something very powerful in our writing. If we can get there, if we can get to our home, if it's our home in our heart, as Sandra says, if it's our home that's physical, if it's a home that's imaginary, get there and tell that story, because that is the story that needs to be told. Get in there, get in those walls, you know, tell those secrets. And she pushed us to do that. Mm-hmm. So that was like something I'll never forget, for sure. Right.
And how what a beautiful reminder, and how art, specifically visual art and, you know, drawing, connect with writing.
Yeah.
And I think that the work that you do is a prime example of that. And so just to end off, I have a few more questions left. My next question is, what does the valley mean to you?
Oh my gosh, I have a poem that came out in the Tejana anthology, Entre Guadalupe y Malinche, and the poem is about driving down to Rio Hondo, which is near El Arroyo, which is a river. It's an estuary of the ocean, right? It's just a river there. And so anyways, long story short, the poem is about driving down to the water and with Erika, my wife, and entering, you know, like there's a certain point on the drive from San Antonio to the valley where the moisture, the bubbles of water and humidity from the ocean and from all the water, the vegetation, it like attaches to the windows, like the water gets on the windows. And it, to me, the valley is like you're entering this like womb, like, it's just so beautiful. I feel when that water hits the windows, when that moisture, that humidity like touches me and I smell, I mean, it's different now, of course, because a lot of the citrus groves are gone. But when I smell the oranges or smell the onions or smell the leña burning and feel the moisture on my skin, I feel like I'm home. I feel wrapped up. I feel more surrounded by my language, my Chicano language, my Pocho language. I feel surrounded by the smells of food. I feel enveloped in love. I feel my grandmother. I feel the strong women that really endured through the civil rights movement. I feel the history. I know the land has so many wounds, and I know that even in the wounds and in the horrible racism and environmental injustice that has occurred by, you know, by so many, you know, that has happened against our people in this land of South Texas and the Valley. We continue to be strong and badass, amazing, powerful people. So the Valley to me is survival, making it. It's about entrepreneurs, you know. When I see the Valley, I'm like, man, everyone's a fucking business owner down here. Everybody has their own negocio, like right out of the truck, right out of their backyard. You know, they're working hard. I also spend a lot of time in the Pulga. And people just making it happen, you know, work weekend jobs, weekend work, selling what they have. So to me, it's hard workers, family, food, celebration, and beautiful space. It's a magic. It's like you're entering, for me, it's like I'm entering the womb. And that's why I talked about that water. It's like you're entering home. Mm-hmm. I love the Valley. It's a magical place for me.
My next question to you is, do you think representation matters?
Oh my gosh, absolutely. Representation absolutely matters. Being, you know, out in public matters. Showing, verbalizing, talking about queerness, talking about lesbianidad, talking about chicanidad, talking about our bodies and gender. Representation, it being visual in the media, in everywhere. Yes, it matters. Just last night, I had family in town, and I was talking to a young one of my new nieces that I had never met. She tells me, we're talking about queerness, and she's talking about, you know, just women in general and media. And we had an intense conversation about how in media, there is no representation of the butch, Chicana, Tejana, hard, dyke. The representation is nowhere for us because our image, the image of a butch dyke, for example, does not satisfy the male gaze. And if it doesn't satisfy the male gaze, it's not there. And there isn't representation for our bodies, you know. But there isn't a lot, and we need to show it. We need to reprogram our minds to see what beauty is. It's not this, like, image of what the man wants to look at, or the male gaze, you know, doesn't satisfy that. So I definitely feel like we need to keep pushing. Our POC community, we all need to be out there pushing for representation, yes.
And my last question to you is, what would you tell your younger self?
My personal younger self, I would have said to her, talk to your grandmother, she would understand you. You know, like, talk to your elders more. Reach out to them. I would say, talk to the grandparents out there. Talk to the 70 and 80 year olds. They actually are more open-minded than we think, you know? No matter what, we've all been friends with queer folks. We've all known LGBT folks. They've all been our best friends. Even, I learned later in life, my father, he lived across the street from a gay man who was a gay teacher who lent my dad his car when he was 16 years old. Like, my dad did errands for this young gay man. Because it was his job, like he needed work, so this man would like let my dad like go buy his groceries and wash his car and all this stuff, and that was his first gay friend, you know. So talk to your elders,